Friday, March 18th, 2022, Connecticut Today wrapping up a busy week. We chatted with the Yankee Institute of Connecticut head Carol Platt Leibau regarding details of the latest Connecticut State employee contract proposal. Southern Connecticut State University biology professor Dr. Sarah Crawford updating us again on the latest COVID-19 variant and a subvariant now that may be lurking. What is the upcoming, the next contract with state employees going to cost the state? And again, I preface any discussions of this saying, of course, the state needs state workers. It needs excellent, fine, efficient state government operation, and workers should be paid fairly. But every time I broach this subject, especially knowing that I have friends and family members who are state workers, it is incumbent, I believe, that the people who live in this state who pay taxes to fund those workers know as much as they can. It's only right about what is in the state worker contracts with CBAC and the bargaining unit. Joining us right now, as her organization has learned a little bit more about what's in these proposed deals, Carol Platt Leibau, who heads the Yankee Institute of Connecticut. Hey, Carol, it's Paul again. How are you?
I'm great. It's great to be with you.
Thank you, Carol. Appreciate it. Well, I got this from your folks earlier today. It is interesting. So what have you folks at the Yankee Institute been able to glean here from some of this information that you've obtained for what is still a proposed deal and I guess has not officially been released to a lot of people? But what have you seen here?
Well, I mean, it looks like there's an incredible giveaway underway to state workers. And just to set the table, you know, CBAC is actually announcing a lot of this stuff in its own brochure. So, I mean, they're bragging about this. What they're not sure about is that, you know, all of us are going to find out about it. They're telling their own members. But, you know, in its own brochure, you know, the fact is that that in 2019, as you know, Paul, state employees pocketed raises in 2019 and 2020 worth 3.5% each year, and they also got seniority-based raises. The 2020 raises were noteworthy because the state had to grant them automatically, and even as, you know, 210,000 people were out of work because of COVID. Now, this year, we already knew that people were going to get automatic longevity increases and a $3,500 bonus from the governor. But now we're in a situation where even on top of that, in July, workers covered by CBAC would also get an $1,000 bonus, an additional 2.5% raise worth about $1,900 on average, and another seniority-based raise averaging about $1,500 where they're eligible. So it just sounds as though we have a massive giveaway on tap for people covered by CBAC. We've talked about again and again, Paul, you know, we have state employees getting raises totally more than 15% when you've looked at what's been promised for this in the next two fiscal years.
All right. We'll get back to Carol momentarily because she did give some interesting numbers there. I have them in front of me myself. And one other aspect of these numbers that would, you know, have a legacy down the road here. Carol Platt Leibau is the guest. She heads the Yankee Institute of Connecticut. We're talking about what the proposal is for a new agreement, multi-year agreement with Connecticut's state employees. First, though, traffic and weather together right here. Then more with Carol on WICC. And the website is yankeeinstitute.org. Once again, yankeeinstitute.org. That is the website. Carol Platt Leibau is the guest. She heads the Yankee Institute, and the folks at the Yankee Institute always bring us some of the info that is tough to find in other areas, and they have some of the info regarding what is still a proposal, nothing solid yet regarding the new contract for state employees. And Carol, before we broke, you were talking about the $2,500 bonus, the retroactive 2.5% raise, the retroactive seniority-based step. And these are important because, Carol, although the percentages sound small, they do build into the legacy costs that they generate, correct?
That's exactly right. They're all what's called pensionable, which means that it becomes part of what a state employee's pension is based on. And those are, as you just said, Paul, part of the legacy costs that all of us become liable for. And that's a good part of the reason that Connecticut finds it so hard to climb out from under the promises that have been made by legislatures past. And, you know, these numbers are just truly startling. And that's why it's just worth going through them again. If you look just at these, you know, across the board raises and the ones that have been promised under this agreement, at least this tentative agreement for this and the next two fiscal years, these deals would have state employees getting raises that would come out to more than 15%. And those are without factoring in seniority raises. When you look at what they've gotten between 2019 and 2023. And so then someone who's received these incremental or step increases that are based on seniority, and those come in around 2%, could see their pay rise almost 26% between 2019 and 2023. Now, Paul, I don't have to tell you or any of your listeners that very few people during 2019 to 2023 in the private sector have seen a 26% pay increase.
No, not at all, Carol. And, you know, but I'm sure there are people, and I know there are because I get calls on these segments all the time and feedback on social media, Carol, and you probably get blowback on this yourself. People saying, well, you know, the quote unquote, why do you hate state employees, or why all the crying and moaning every time there's a new state employee contract? And Carol, I go out of my way to say it all the time. Look, state employees have to get paid. You know that. I know that. We want good, competitive work in the state. The state has to function. But I think, Carol, as you mentioned, it is often a question of proportion here. And what, as you say, and I know some people, Carol, say, well, you can't compare it. But humans being what they are, they will compare this to what goes on in the private sector. They just will.
Well, yes. And, you know, of course, you know, of course, people have to be paid and everyone should be able to earn a living. But what's important to understand is that if we want our state to be competitive as a whole, what we need to have is a state workforce that exists to serve and support the private sector, not a private sector that exists to serve and support the state workforce. And I think sometimes there are too many people who run our government unions who forget that. And the fact is that things that can't go on forever won't go on forever. And if our state simply runs out of money to support these very, very generous arrangements, then what our younger workers need to understand is that if the money isn't there, they are the ones who are going to stand to suffer very badly if the promises that have been made to them simply can't be kept. And so it's more important to be realistic about what actually can and should be done, rather than rushing to make payments up front and promises that won't be kept for them later on.
The website, of course, YankeeInstitute.org, YankeeInstitute.org. Check them out on social media as well. Carol Platt-Leibau has been the guest. Carol, as always, thank you for the time. Have a happy weekend, and we shall talk down the road. Thanks.
Thanks, Paul.
All right, appreciate it. And there you go, folks. You can check out the particulars in the contract, and maybe you approve of them, maybe you don't, at YankeeInstitute.org. And Carol's point needs to be amplified and repeated. No one is saying here that state workers should not be paid, fairly, be paid with equity into what they do. The state needs the 40-something thousand people and employees to function. Every state needs employees. Every city, every town does. But it is what terms, it's the term, what terms do these terms make financial sense for the state? In other words, the state, you and I as taxpayers, we are the employers here. And yes, municipal and state workers do not work in the private sector. They made a conscious effort, a legal and good and conscious effort to help run the state. That's to be applauded. But as is the problem here sometimes with municipal unions, the idea here is that almost every request to raise pay in new contracts goes up and up and up. And the reason that people get a little upset with this is they say, well, my private employer can't give out. And this is the question. This is the main question here. We all know that private employers have to watch their cash flow, their expenses, their outlays, and then they will bracket a certain amount of money to be available for payroll, and then that payroll will be divvied out on importance of a job, seniority, and everything. Okay, so why doesn't the state have to do that? Why? And I'm just, this is kind of an open-ended question, but look at the millions and millions and millions of people who get no raises or rarely get raises from the private sector. And yet, public sector raises are almost expected. And that, whether it's right or wrong, it engenders anger and a disconnect from some people. When a lot of the people who are watching their dollars and cents, who have not gotten raises, are forced to pay higher taxes because there is a segment of the workforce that is virtually guaranteed to get those raises. So is there any unfairness there or not? Want to get a check-in, though, from one of our go-to folks regarding COVID-19 and what is up now with this new sub-variant, a variant of a variant. Joining us right now, as she's been kind enough to do all throughout the last 2 years, is Dr. Sarah Crawford, professor of biology at Southern Connecticut State University. Dr. Crawford, it's Paul again here. How are you, and thanks for coming on. How you been?
Thank you, Paul. It's my pleasure, and I've been great, and it's good to talk to you again.
Well, thanks so much for the time, and I appreciate it. I wanted to have you on because now we're starting to see, you know, supposedly, and we've seen the numbers kind of tail off for Omicron and Delta. So let's start with the new, I don't want to say fears, but there are, I guess, some concerns about this new subvariant, BA2. Do I have that right? What is it?
You got that right, yes. So we're in a lull right now, much appreciated in most of the United States. Omicron has been subdued. It has spread as far as it's probably going to go for the most part. But now we see in Europe in particular a surge in what we're calling Omicron 2, which is a descendant of Omicron 1, which has a lot more mutations and has a lot of differences. But in the UK right now, they have the highest level of COVID incidence since the beginning of the pandemic. And that's due to Omicron, too. So it's a little bit worrisome and it may be headed in our direction.
So, Dr. Crawford, obviously, I guess the transmissibility is very high because you and the other experts I've had on have said, you know, these mutations become more transmissible. What about the what about the power of this one, this BA2, this the capacity of this to cause illness? What do we know about that, if anything, so far?
Well, fortunately, it doesn't seem to be much more infectious than the Omicron 1. So far, so good. There hasn't been increases in hospitalizations that are remarkable or increases in deaths. So it appears that its potency really is in its ability to infect. It's about 30% more infectious than Omicron 1. And it is evading vaccines and previous infections and is occurring in people who might otherwise be protected based on their history. So it's clear that it's already present in 47 states in the United States. So it's clear that it probably will be increasing over the next month or so.
The guest is Dr. Sarah Crawford, professor of biology, Southern Connecticut State University. Dr. Crawford, hang on. We're going to put you on hold. We'll be right back with you, getting the lowdown here in the skinny on the latest situation with now a new variant, an Omicron subvariant BA2. More on this when we return. First on the 6's Traffic and Weather Together, 4:36 on WICC. And catching you up on the latest in the study and the prevention of infection from COVID-19, Dr. Sarah Crawford, return visit from her, professor of biology at Southern Connecticut State University. Now, Dr. Crawford, of course, the big thing is we're starting to see the debate heat up. I read at least four or five things on it today regarding a possible second booster. That would be a fourth shot for some period, for some people, rather, in a specific period of time. There's differing options being offered by Pfizer and Moderna. There's some disagreement here among professionals. What are your thoughts on this, and what are you able to glean from this so far?
Well, I think we're in muddy waters, actually, and that's why there's so much back and forth on this. It optimally, one would think that if something is good, more is better. And I think that's sort of the idea behind the booster in general. It has been shown that levels of protection go down over time, and that a booster can rebuild that immune protection against other variants. But there are many questions, because these Omicron variants are not as are able to resist some of the immunity provided by the vaccines. So that's one problem. And the other question is, when you're dealing with an infection that, at least as far as we can tell, seems to be less severe, then the necessity for widespread boostering becomes more questionable in the sense of risk benefit. So there is quite a bit of debate going on, and I know that there is a request in for the fourth booster, but it's not clear that it would be extremely beneficial for all groups in the population, certainly individuals at high risk. Certainly that seems like a good group to target, but whether everyone would benefit, it's really too early to tell.
Yeah, and I did see, I don't know whether it was the Pfizer or the Moderna request specifically, it was one or the other where they said, Dr. Crawford, another booster in our minds would be good for people 65 and over. The other one was for the entire population. And I can only help and recall way back when this all started a couple of years back, reading as much as I could and sopping up as much as I could on this as quickly as I could. I do remember reading some academics that said that the legacy of this is always going to be protecting those 60 or 65 and above, no matter all the peaks and valleys. Do you think that was, looking back on that, pretty accurate, do you think, or not?
Well, you know, hindsight has 20/20. So when we're going into this, we had no idea how the epidemiological profile was going to shape up. So, yes, that has turned out to be the highest risk group, and it hasn't become more deadly for lower ages for the most part. So, yes, that certainly seems to be the group that needs the most protection. But going in, you know, we didn't know what was going on, and so we did the best we could at the time. I think that's a lot of how we're going to do a ex post facto analysis of this pandemic. But clearly, there are a lot of issues that remain, not only in terms of the origin of the virus itself, in terms of the transparency of pharmaceutical companies, in terms of the necessity of certain mandates. There will be a lot of debate, and I think much of it is important, because we're not out of this yet, and I think we need to be better prepared for the future. In future pandemics, if they occur, hopefully not, but certainly in dealing with what's going on now, which isn't going to go away anytime soon.
Dr. Sarah Crawford as a guest, a few more minutes with her from Southern Connecticut State University, a professor of biology. Doctor, I was reading a couple of days ago that already there are going to be several generics of this Pfizer COVID-19 pill. Paxlovid, I guess, is the brand name. And was I correct in seeing and reading that some of the early results of this have been very, very good and very encouraging?
Yes. It is very encouraging. I think that that is one of the big breakthroughs, in addition to the vaccines, being able to treat the infection earlier on. So as long as you get an early treatment, it seems to really reduce the infection severity and symptoms and longevity of the disease. So this is a very promising result. Certainly, we'll have to see how it works with these variants that keep popping up. But so far, so good. It has had very promising results.
Finally, Doctor, I know there's this other variant out there, but our numbers keep going down, and we're getting into the warmer weather now where there may be some natural effect of the warmth and the sunlight, and people are outside more. They're inside less. So, I mean, barring anything crazy over the next few months, do you think or not that, you know, the summer and the early fall and spring could be okay, but then we would have to be on guard again when the colder weather comes in a few months and the cycle might begin again all over again?
Well, that's certainly possible. We do see that these infections do have a seasonal component. I think right now what we're most interested in is the BA2 and how it's going to affect individuals in the United States. I mean, the one positive aspect of some of these later variants is that they do provide a level of immunity, which may not be totally afforded by vaccines. So you may get a protection against further infection. But the fact that we have an unstable situation worldwide, that we have China and other countries really affected very severely by new outbreaks of COVID, raises the possibility of future variants coming up. So, yes, we're going to go through Omicron 2 with a positive attitude and a hopeful attitude, but we can never forget that this virus is capable of mutating in ways that are unpredictable, and that as we go into another winter, we may have more issues to deal with. So we'll just have to wait and see what happens.
Thanks once again, Dr. Sarah Crawford, Professor of Biology, Southern Connecticut State University. Dr. Crawford, as always, we thank you for your time, for putting it in plain English for us, and we'll talk down the road. Thank you so much.
Thank you so much, Paul.
All right. Thanks, Dr. Sarah Crawford there, Professor of Biology, Southern Connecticut State University. And her overall message was, we're doing okay. We're still getting our hands around this, but it ain't over yet.